Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I'm going to start in a kind of an odd place. Clarence Darrow was a great American jurist. And if any of you have seen a famous movie called Inherit the Wind, anyone see that? It's a very old one, 1960. Spencer Tracy played Darrow, the lawyer in the famous Scopes Monkey trial. That was the trial in which famously a high school teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, found to have broken state law by teaching Darwinian evolution in the public school that he taught in. That was the Scopes Monkey trial. And then it was dramatized in this film very very powerfully. Well, that was not a fictional character. Clarence Darrow lived from 1857 to 1938 and was a counsel for the defense in several famous criminal trials before the Scopes Monkey trial, including, kind of a side note, but in 1924, Darrow defended Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb from the death penalty for their gratuitous murder of the 14-year-old Robert Franks. And this was a famous headline-making murder case in which a couple of students decided to put, as they understood it, the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche into practice by taking the role of the Übermenschen and killing randomly a totally innocent fellow student. Now, probably any good philosophy professor would say they had misunderstood Nietzsche. Nietzsche wasn't encouraging people to go out and commit gratuitous murders. But nonetheless, Darrow made kind of a name for himself in defending this notorious pair. He also made a little bit of a splash by issuing in 1929 an essay that he called The Myth of the Soul. And the title kind of says it all, The Myth of the Soul. So the soul is a myth, is a story, a fiction, something that we use to talk about other realities. And I'm going to begin with a few quotations, which I have on the handout under number one, from his essay, The Myth of the Soul, to kind of pose the question in its most stark form. And then we'll move on from that to some more philosophical thinkers. So what does Clarence Darrow say in The Myth of the Soul? Well, he questions whether, quote, the belief in immortality is necessary or even desirable. Is it necessary? Is it desirable? Notice he doesn't ask if it's true. He asks if it's a necessary belief or a desirable belief. And he concludes, neither. The belief in the soul is neither necessary nor desirable. Like many of the intellectuals in his generation, Darrow did not think it was possible to attain scientific certitude, like the kind we have in physics and chemistry, about questions like, is there an immortal soul? It was very common, at least among a certain class and education, to assume that such questions could be answered only by opinion, by feeling, or perhaps by myth. Science tells us what we can see. Science gives us data about the empirical world or forms theories about the world as ascertained through empirical data. So when we come to a question like, is there a soul? Is there an immortal soul? Where do we go? We have to examine, since we can't know empirically, right? It's the soul, if it exists, is not an empirical thing that we can put under a microscope or subject to testing. So how do we get further with examining whether it exists? Well, we can only go on a probability. How probable is it that something like the soul exists? He wants to know. Well, what difference does it make if a man believes that he has a soul that continues after death or not? And Darrow's answer is not very much. Not very much. Those who believe in an immortal soul, he says, seem to fear death and avoid it just as much as anybody else. On the handout, this is quotation 1A. If people really believed in a beautiful, happy, glorious land waiting to receive them when they died, if they believed that their friends would be waiting to meet them, if they believed that all pain and suffering would be left behind, why should they live through weeks, months, and even years of pain and torture while cancer eats its way to the vital parts of the body? Why should one fight off death? he answers his own question, because he does not believe in any real sense. Everyone knows that there is no real evidence of any such state of bliss. The proximity of death shows up this belief for what it really is, Darrow thinks, wishful thinking. We want the soul to exist, to keep on existing after death. And so we kind of form this myth. Human societies have created this myth and sometimes recounted it in very elaborate forms. Darrow goes on then to address the topic of the resurrection of the body, which is different from the existence of the soul, but obviously connected. Regarding that, regarding the resurrection of the body, Darrow admits that Christians base their hope of a future life on this teaching, the resurrection of the body, but he's also skeptical about that. He says, this is a purely religious doctrine. This is quote 1b on the handout. It is safe to say that few intelligent men who are willing to look obvious facts in the face hold any such belief. Yet we are seriously told that Elijah was carried bodily to heaven in a chariot of fire, and that Jesus arose from the dead and ascended into heaven. The New Testament abounds in passages that support this doctrine. Well, he's right about that. St. Paul states the tenet over and over again. The Apostles' Creed says, I believe in the resurrection of the body. This has been carried into substantially all the Orthodox creeds, and while it is more or less minimized by neglect and omission, it is still a cardinal doctrine of the Orthodox churches. Now, he's writing this in 1929, remember. Darrow affirms here that the resurrection of the body is the Orthodox Christian doctrine. It's in St. Paul. It's in the Gospels. This is absolutely true. Of course, what he says about it then is rather dismissive. Well, this doctrine arose, quote, 2,000 years ago in Palestine when little was known of man or the earth or of the universe. So fairly dismissive. You know, how could anyone who lived 2,000 years ago know anything, especially in comparison to what we know now through science? Modern science teaches us that in the millions of years in which men have walked the earth and matter, which made up prehistoric men's bodies, has been returned to the earth and reused countless times to make up other bodies, human and other. Never in all that time, Darrow would say, has it ever happened that someone has returned definitively from the dead. We can find evidence of this in any cemetery you like. There's this pesky belief, though. There's this human desire to believe that death is not the end, that we have these souls that go on forever. This is quote 1c. The idea that man is a being set apart, distinct from all the rest of nature, is born of man's emotions, of his loves and hates, of his hopes and fears, and the primitive conception of undeveloped minds. The you and the I, which is known to our friends, does not consist of an immaterial thing called a soul, which cannot be conceived. We know perfectly well what we mean when we talk about this you and this me. It is equally plain that the whole fabric that makes up our separate personalities is destroyed, dispersed, disintegrated beyond repair by what we call death. So, in other words, Darrow is saying no intelligent modern person can really believe in the myth of the soul. This was maybe understandable among those poor ancient and medieval people who didn't know any better, but for us intelligent moderns, how could we continue to hold this belief? Obviously there's a lot of rhetoric in this approach. It's very dismissive, wouldn't fly so well today as it apparently did, at least among certain groups in the 1920s. But Darrow, I think, makes a couple of important points, and I want to highlight those two points before we go backwards to those poor ancients such as Plato and Aristotle. One, Darrow admits that Christians believe in an immortal soul, which is not destroyed by death but lives forever. On the other hand, as he points out, Christians, like everybody else, are afraid of death and do try to prolong their lives. Two of you, at least, and there are three of you, are studying medicine, nursing. I mean, the whole point of these fields is to preserve life, to help us live longer and live healthier lives. Everyone agrees that that's a good thing. That includes Christians who believe that death is not the end. So what do we do with that? Well, I mean, of course, what Darrow does with that is say that proves that Christians are inconsistent. They don't really believe what they say they believe. They don't really believe that there's a heaven or they're not very strong in that belief. And maybe, I guess one could say, this could represent a sort of disconnect between belief and action. Maybe many of us do find it hard to keep believing in the immortality of our soul when we're faced with the reality of death, because death is difficult. That may be. But whatever else it indicates, it certainly points to one thing, that it's difficult for us to hold to this belief in the soul precisely because it's something we can't see, whereas the body and everything that's happening to the body is so present to our senses. So whether it's true or not, whether the doctrine of the soul is true or not, it's not going to be something easy to hold on to and consistently maintain. Second point that Darrow makes, helpfully, is that the resurrection of the body, while a distinct idea from the immortality of the soul, is actually closely connected to it in every Orthodox Christian creed, right? They go hand in hand. Our souls are immortal. They were created by God, and they'll never be, their existence will never end. And because of that, and because that soul was created to live in a body, we have this promise of, in the future, receiving our bodies back, right? That's the doctrine of the resurrection. So Darrow was right to say that Christians base their hope for a future life upon, in some sense, upon the idea of the resurrection of the body. But it wasn't quite right in the way that Darrow meant it. So we'll have to correct that at the end. What we're going to explore tonight is this idea that we have an immortal soul, something that we hold by faith if we're Christian, but also something that reason has some access to. So the philosophical tradition itself offers certain reasons for holding the immortality of the soul. And faith offers this same teaching to us, the immortality of the soul, hand in hand with the teaching of the resurrection of the body, which is a revealed truth, not something we can know through reason. Death in the ancient world. Okay, so the second part I want to talk about, especially Plato and Aristotle, but leading into that with the poets and a more non-philosophical ancient view. All ancient thinkers, whether they were poets or philosophers, believed in a soul. Even at an extreme, the most materialistic of the ancient schools was a school called Epicureanism, founded by Epicurus in Athens, which famously taught that the ultimate good is pleasure. It's hedonism. But even the Epicureans, although they were materialists and they said that the only thing that exists is atoms and void, still they talked about soul. They just said the soul was made up of atoms, right? Easy solution. So even they did not drop the soul out altogether. We have to wait till modern times for such opinions. Yet, arguably, none of the ancients arrived at a really secure scientific demonstration of the immortality of the soul. But some of them tried. All the ancients are in agreement, more or less, about the importance of the soul, and most of them envision that something happens to the soul after death. Now, for the Epicureans, there's something of the exception because they don't think the soul atoms can be destroyed, but they get dispersed, and then they go to make up other things, other souls later on. So they don't get materially annihilated, but they don't continue to exist as you or I. Most of the other ancient schools of philosophy and just ordinary people and the poets envision some sort of personal continuance of life after death. But as we were talking about earlier, before dinner, that the poets, especially Homer, envisioned this state, Hades, right, the state of being dead, as a pretty terrible place. It's not in any way identical to hell, right? It's not a place of torture and punishment so much as a very shadowy place, a somewhat unreal and definitely not a place you want to go and spend time in if you're still among the living. An example of this, just one example in Homer's Odyssey, he portrays Odysseus. He learns that he has to go to Hades. He's still alive. He has to go to Hades as part of his journey to get back to his home. And when he tells the men on his ship that this is where they're going next, they sit down and weep. You know, these are strong sailors, and they break down in tears when they learn that they have to go down to Hades with poor Odysseus. And the dead themselves, so we see the dead in Homer, they're like these shadowy beings, and they're not happy. They don't even recognize the people they knew in life until they've drunk from the blood of animals that Odysseus has sacrificed. So they exist, right? These people still exist in some way, but not fully and not really. Like there's something sort of unreal about their existence, some shadowy life. There's a quotation. I do not have this on the handout, but this is from Cardinal Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, his book Eschatology. He kind of sums up this thinking of the ancient world as a whole masterfully. And he says, complete nothingness for the ancients, annihilation of the human soul, was not even thinkable. The afterlife, which is not life but a curious mixture of being and nothingness, on the one hand was rendered possible by rites of passage with their provision of food for the dead, and on the other was itself an object of great fear. This shared view of all early cultures, according to which only this life is really life, whilst death is being suspended in nothingness, was everywhere superseded as man's final word on the matter in the course of his own spiritual revolution. So we have this picture painted to us of the ancient view of, you know, being dead as somehow continuing to exist, but in a very undesirable way, in this kind of shadowy, unreal manner. What's the spiritual revolution that happens? Well, prior to the Christian spiritual revolution, there's the philosophical revolution of Plato and Aristotle and their fellow philosophers. So the view that I just described, the view of the poets, let's call it, is in contrast to the view of the philosophers, who are kind of like the scientists of the day. So they present a different view, a view based in rational knowledge about the fate of the soul. Cicero reported once about the Greek philosopher Anaxagoras, who was another Greek philosopher prior to Socrates, who on, quote, on hearing of the death of his son said, "I knew that my son was mortal." That was his response, not like breaking down in tears or becoming angry, but the calm, cool reason. Well, I knew he was mortal. That is, he would have died at some point. So you're not telling me anything that's new. The philosopher is the one who, like Anaxagoras, disperses the mist of man's blind hopes in some sort of afterlife or in some sort of continued existence forever, hoping without really knowing what one hopes, dismissing those mists through the hand of reason. I was aware that I had begotten a mortal. But at the same time, the philosopher, by dispersing these blind hopes for postponing death indefinitely, he's also directing our attention to what lies behind the misty veil of death. So it's foolish to keep hope and to act as if death is not real, to act as if we're just going to live forever. That's the part of the fool. But dismissing those phantoms doesn't necessarily mean giving into despair about the afterlife. Perhaps there's something behind. Enter the person of Socrates. Socrates does not simply reaffirm the scientific reality of mortality, but he directs our attention to the nature of the soul. The soul is that part of man by which he looks on immortal realities, good, truth, beauty. Those realities are not subject to deterioration like the body is. While his gaze is thus fixed on what is undying, Socrates can go to his own death by execution with absolute equanimity, full of hope that what lies beyond the veil of death is not only something, some vague something, but something better. Something better. Because the soul is something better than the body. So is this life is good, which it is. What makes it good is the soul, not the body. And the soul is what continues to exist even after the body has decayed. Plato in Phaedo gives us this amazing example of Socrates to show us that death can be faced with equanimity, not with fear, but with hope. And that he's saying to us, I think, through Socrates, that shows us what is the supreme outcome, the goal of the philosophical life. It's to prepare us for death, right? And a good death is the culmination of the philosophical life. But one might ask, I think it's natural for us to ask, was this a reasonable hope on the part of Socrates? Because he didn't have any definite knowledge about what would happen to him. He had the poems of Homer, but those weren't very encouraging. Who wants to be in that place where you don't even recognize the people who come to you from the world of the living and you envy them, as Homer has one of his characters say to Odysseus, that he would rather be a slave in Hades than a king upon the earth. So where does Socrates get this hope? Is it simply through philosophy? Is it some sort of intuition that he has? Well, interestingly, right, Socrates does claim to have some arguments, some philosophical arguments that show that the soul is immortal, that it cannot be destroyed. But those arguments are notoriously a little tricky, and hardly anyone really is convinced by them. If you're interested, I won't go through them here, but if you're interested in Plato's Phaedo, he has Socrates recount at least three distinct arguments for the immortality of the soul. But it seems like only Socrates is really convinced by them. Even his interlocutors in the dialogue are presenting all sorts of objections. Now, I think we could say about those arguments what Plato has Socrates say in another dialogue to his friend Meno, talking about another matter, a connected matter of knowledge. So the idea that there's a kind of reminiscence that we know everything through recollection. And Socrates says to Meno, after they've arrived at this conclusion, that everything that we know, everything that we can know, we already know. That knowledge is already present within us, but needs to be recalled. Socrates insists, I do not insist that my argument is right in all other respects. But I would contend at all costs, both in word and deed, as far as I could, that we will be better men, braver, and less idle if we believe this teaching than if we believe that it is not true. So I think we could transfer that reasoning to the existence of the soul. Socrates might say, I can't really insist that this account is perfectly sound in all respects, but I am sure that it's better to hope for a better thing after death than not to hope, even if we're in a great deal of doubt about what that life after death will consist in, what it will look like. We ought to hope that it will be better. The philosopher doesn't hate life. He doesn't hate being in the body and alive because it's life in a body. So it's not as if he wants to escape into a pure life of the soul out of rejection of the body. But in a different sense, Socrates, or the philosopher, hates the body. He hates the body in the sense that he loves the soul more. He puts his value in the soul. I put it this way, he stakes his claim in the life of the soul rather than the life of the body. So this is a sort of existential choice that the philosopher makes. I will not live by the logic of the body, the logic of bodily life and death. I will live by the logic of immortality, the logic of the soul. And that means I don't see death as this sort of disaster, but as a transition, as something that my soul will undergo, which may involve pain and difficulty and a kind of a purification process even, but that is not the end, right? Is not the cataclysm. So there are these two poles in ancient thought that I think it will help us to keep in mind. One is the represented by the poets. That's this idea that we are afraid of death. Hades is a terrible place we don't want to go to, but we're going to go there anyway. And the other is the philosophical view of Plato, especially presented in the person of Socrates, which says, don't be afraid of death. You will continue. And for those who have acted justly in this life, there's a hope of something better. Aristotle enters into this picture in some ways as a sort of a confrontation, maybe if not quite a synthesis, between these two traditional views, the view of the poets and then the more scientific view of the philosophers. So scientifically, Aristotle understands the human being to be an animal who, like every other animal, has a life principle or soul. Aristotle's definition of the soul is the form of a natural body having life potentially within it. I learned that you'll have a lecture later in the semester about trees and souls. Do trees have souls? Possibly. Well, Aristotle would have said yes. Hope I'm not giving away the future lecturer's thesis there. But if he's an Aristotelian, he'll tell you that trees have souls. But of course, nobody would call their souls immortal, or at least nobody in the ancient world would have suggested that. Body and soul together for living things are one being, and that's an organism. And the unity of an organism is such that neither can it exist on its own without the soul, nor can the body cannot exist without the soul, but nor can the soul exist without the body in the sense that it needs the organs of the body to act, right, to operate. If trees do end up having souls, well, what would a tree soul do without branches and roots and a trunk? You know, it just would be an idea, right? Well, in fact, that's kind of what it is. What is the soul of a tree without a tree body? Well, it's our idea of a tree, right? It's just the form of the tree. So that's no problem with trees and things like frogs. But when it comes to the human being, we have a sense that this is not right, that there's something better or different about human souls, right? And of course, this is a very traditional idea that the human soul is of a different kind than animal or plant souls. That is, than the life. Our life is a different sort of a life. But for us, death is also natural, right? Our bodies are very much our life, and our souls exist in the body as one organism, just as with all other organisms. This other element in us, what Aristotle calls nous or mind, is rather mysterious. It's very much real. And Aristotle says in his book On the Soul that nous or mind, quote, seems to be a substance that comes to be in the human animal and to be imperishable. This leaves open the possibility that the mind is something more divine and unaffected. And unaffected means can't be dissolved, can't be corrupted, can't die. Right. So there's this tantalizing idea, right, that there's something of the human soul, call it mind or spirit or whatever you will. There's something of the human soul which is not able to be dissolved, corrupted, die. And Aristotle also adds that the soul, or at least the mind aspect of the soul, it is further in its separate state that the intellect is just that which it is, and it is this alone that is immortal and eternal. Though we have no memory, as the separate intellect is unaffected, while the intellect that is affected is perishable, and in any case thinks nothing without the other. This is a kind of hard and very mysterious passage, which has been interpreted in a number of different ways. I won't get into that, but you can see from this that Aristotle is both hinting at, or more than hinting at, is gesturing toward something in the human soul, which is immortal. He even says divine. Those would be practically interchangeable for any ancient immortal and divine. And yet at the same time, it's hard to imagine our intellect being separate from the rest of us. If that's what Aristotle was suggesting, that's a way of existing that's very strange to us and unfamiliar. And we're not quite sure what that would mean. So in Aristotle, what we have is this sort of scientific philosophical analysis of the soul, which recognizes death as something natural to man as an animal, with this one caveat of mind, which cannot be affected in the manner of the body, and which should suggest some mysterious share in the divine and the immortal. On the other hand, Aristotle also writes in his ethical works, especially the Nicomachean Ethics, in a very different way about death. So he references a traditional idea that the dead can actually be benefited or harmed by what their descendants do or fail to do. And this is quote number 4 on the handout. And this quote, he's speculating, not giving a kind of a definitive account of his own, but he's acknowledging what are the normal opinions that people have. And how can we account for those opinions? How can we take them all into account in a way that makes sense? So he says, it would be odd if the dead man would share in the vicissitudes of his descendants and be happy at one time and wretched at another, right? Because your descendants could have all kinds of fortunes. So maybe your great-grandchildren do really well, but then your great-great-grandchildren fall into poverty and destitution. And so then does the dead person, like, go from being happy to being sad, depending on what's happening to his descendants? That would be, as Aristotle says so dryly, that would be odd. But it would also be odd if the fortunes of their descendants did not affect the ancestors at all, not even for a short time. The good as well as the bad fortunes of their friends seem then to have some effect upon the dead. But the nature and magnitude of the effect is such as not to make the happy unhappy or to produce any similar changes. So it seems, Aristotle's suggesting, I think that, first of all, the dead still exist in some way, right? They certainly can't be affected if they don't exist anymore. So that's clear. The dead continue to exist, but they exist in such a way that they cannot truly act. They are purely passive recipients of what their descendants are doing, insofar as they're able to receive effects of what their descendants are doing. But clearly they themselves aren't able to act, to affect the fortunes of others, or to act in any significant way. You might say that Aristotle represents an advance in scientific thinking, using science in the ancient sense of, more broad than the modern sense, but an organized body of knowledge. Aristotle represents an advance in scientific thinking over Plato in that he offers an explanation for our bodiliness, right? This idea of the soul-body unity. At the same time, Aristotle seems to pull back somewhat from the Socratic confidence about the eternal life, the eternal destiny of the soul. But it's even more troublesome insofar as Aristotle's seeming lack of conviction about the immortality of the soul seems to be a direct consequence of his scientific advance. It is because of the close union of soul and body as form and matter that the continued existence of soul after death is put into doubt. So it would seem that the more clearly we understand the intimate union, the unity of the human being's body and soul, the harder it is to think of the soul as existing apart from the body. So we might be excused from concluding that the disillusionment in the hope of immortality is just the price we have to pay for scientific understanding of the human being. That was more or less Clarence Darrow's claim. We modern scientific people can't continue to hold in this ancient myth of the soul. Against this rather disheartening conclusion, we are going to look now briefly to St. Thomas Aquinas, one of whose great achievements was to synthesize Plato and Aristotle, to synthesize their insights about the soul, maintaining along with Plato that the human soul is a spiritual thing. So Aquinas says that the human soul is an intellectual substance. That's the term he uses. But also with Aristotle, that the human being is a body-soul unity, that this spiritual substance that is our soul is also the form of the material body to which it is so closely united that the two actually form one thing. Thomas Aquinas sees that if we arrive at the conclusion that the soul is this kind of thing, an immaterial substance, then we will also be led necessarily to the conclusion that the soul is an indestructible substance, and that there are scientific reasons for holding that the soul is this kind of thing. And his argument, which I'm going to condense into just a very brief synopsis, his argument is founded on the specifically human activity, which is called intellectus in Aquinas, or also ratio, is this twofold intellectual activity. Starting with an example familiar to us, mathematical thinking. We think, what is it to think mathematically? This is an immaterial activity, even though it starts from from material objects. Math might begin from measuring things that are material, but it goes far beyond them, right? If anyone has advanced beyond basic arithmetic, we see immediately that we're now no longer dealing with material entities. Abstract numbers are not material entities. Neither are perfect triangles. But in truth, so that's already, mathematics is already thinking in a non-material way or a spiritual way. This is why, for Plato, mathematics, especially geometry, was a necessary preparation for philosophy. It was a prerequisite. Well, in truth, there's something even more abstract than mathematics, philosophy. But let me take an example that's more everyday. If someone says the system is unjust, he's thinking immaterially. If I say the system or the structure is unjust, I'm making a judgment about a structure, which, first of all, is something invisible. Now, of course, say a governmental structure or a structure of a university, for example, has material elements, but in itself, it's not a material thing. Moreover, I'm talking about justice, which is certainly not a material thing. And even further, if I say this is unjust, if I say there's lacking justice in the system, I'm speaking of the absence of an immaterial quality and a non-material thing, right? It's three layers of abstract thinking going on here, or non-material thinking. So anyone who says something like, you know, that the system is racially biased, or that person is biased, is exercising this spiritual form of thinking, this non-material thinking. And we can, moreover, go even further. We can think about beings who are wholly non-material, such as angels, and especially, of course, God. We have at University of Dallas, I don't know if you have a similar class in the philosophy department here at USF, but we have a philosophy of God class. But imagine having a whole class about something that was not real. I mean, you could still have a philosophy of God class that was like a sort of fiction or science fiction class. But even if you did that, right? I mean, even if you were a complete atheist, right? And you decided you were going to take philosophy of God or teach philosophy of God, you could do that. You'd be having conversations about abstract, non-material ideas, right? Even if you thought they were essentially based in a falsity. That's still immaterial thinking. So even an atheist could agree with Aquinas about this conclusion that we have this capability of spiritual faculty, which he calls intellect, which can exercise spiritual or non-material thinking. But here's the thing. If I'm the kind of being that can think immaterial thoughts, I must be an immaterial kind of being. Right, so every action requires an agent. Like if there's swimming is an action. But if there's swimming, there must be a swimmer. Who's ever heard of swimming without a swimmer? Or eating without an eater? Likewise, if there's thinking, there's a thinker. Students of modern philosophy will recognize here a little echo of René Descartes' cogito ergo sum. If I think, therefore I am, this idea that thought implies a thinker was actually not new to Descartes, but it's true. Ultimately, it's true that if there's thought going on, there's a thinker. But what's a thinker? Well, a thinker cannot be simply a bunch of cells or even a very, very complex bunch of cells. There must be some spiritual substance, which is the ground of spiritual activity. And all I mean by spiritual activity is non-material activity, like thinking about math, thinking about philosophy. But that's precisely what is meant by an immortal soul. An immortal soul and a spiritual soul are two different words for the same thing. So if we're thinkers, if thinking is what we think it is, then there must be a soul. Otherwise, we'd be saying something equally absurd to saying, well, there's eating, but there's no eater, or there's swimming, but there's no swimmer. Now, this is only a very sketchy version of what is a complex argument or set of arguments, which, if you're interested, you can read in St. Thomas's Summa Theologiae in the Prima Pars, question 75, or Summa Contra Gentiles, book 2. But hopefully you've heard enough to see kind of what the form of the argument is. And that brings us at last to the resurrection of the body. So a theological conclusion that we're heading to. When St. Paul preached to the Gentiles his famous sermon in the Areopagus, he didn't need to argue that there was a soul. If you go back and read Acts of the Apostles 17, you'll notice that he doesn't talk about that at all. He doesn't try to prove to the ancient people of Athens that there was a soul, because nobody doubted that. Now, they doubted lots of other things. What was the soul made of? How does it continue to exist after death? Does it really continue to exist personally after death, as we would say? All kinds of questions about the soul. But St. Paul did need to proclaim that the resurrection of the body was possible. Now, there were many ancient philosophers, including Plato, who had ideas about reincarnation of the body, that is, reincarnation of the soul in a different body, right? So that was a very traditional idea, and Plato made use of it. He never, I think, committed to it in any kind of definitive way, but he certainly introduced that idea many times in his dialogues as one way of explaining what the soul is going to do, what is the ultimate fate of our souls as they continue to exist. But nobody before Christ had ever, to my knowledge, proposed the idea that we would get back this very body, right? Not some other body, not going to an animal or tree body or some other existence, a star. That was an idea too. Plato would have liked us to have heavenly bodies, star bodies. But nobody had been so absurd or daring, I suppose, to suggest that we could get this very body back, the very one that we're in right now. That had to be revealed. And in fact, it was revealed. Why did it have to be revealed? Well, I mean, for one thing, we see what happens to the body. Like, there's no mystery there. We know with death, the body begins its inevitable process of decay, and eventually there's nothing left. And that those very materials, those atoms and molecules that make up our body, then go into the ground and become plant food, and then whatever the plant, the grass becomes cattle food, and the cattle become human food, and the cycle continues, right? So we know that. How then can we come to believe in the resurrection of the body? Is it just blind faith? Of course, Clarence Darrow would say it's just wishful thinking, right? We'd really like to get back in our body, so let's pretend that we can. Is there any possibility of empirical evidence of the resurrection of the body? What would that look like? Well, you know, you've probably heard of various accounts, some more and some less plausible, of people who see ghosts or have messages from the dead. A departed one who comes to them in a dream, say, people who have experiences of death and then come back. And we can't rule out the truth of those. I suppose those things are possible. We also can't rule out psychological causes. It's notoriously hard to come to any conclusion about those stories, right? But whatever else we say about them, they're ephemeral, right? These are short experiences, and then people move on. Maybe it changes them, maybe it doesn't. But it's not something like we can pin down and test. But what if someone I knew personally came back to life, not just in a sort of ghostly form or in a dream or something, but what if someone came back to life in a bodily form after having died? That would be pretty persuasive, right? That would be closer to empirical proof. But presumably then that person would die again. Like someone dies and comes back to life, but at least in all the examples that we know of, minus one, that person dies again. And that might lead us to conclude that maybe he wasn't really dead, or he's like seemed dead, but then came back to life, or, maybe we were imprecise in declaring death, or, maybe some extraordinary thing happened there. Well, what if though someone came back to death from a really violent death, the kind of death where there could be no doubt that the person really did die. It's not a question, was the machine really keeping the person alive while he seemed to be dead? No. I mean, what if someone was like really and surely dead and then came back? And then what if, moreover, he came back in such a way that he clearly had the same body, and yet that body would no longer be subject to death? That would teach us two things, at least. One, by the fact that he really died and was truly dead, and then came back as the same person, we could certainly conclude that his soul never died, right? His soul continued to exist while the body was in the grave and then was reunited with the body. So it would help to reaffirm our belief in the existence of the soul. And then second, by the fact that he cannot die again, we would be led to the conclusion that he has his own body in a new kind of way. His own body, but somehow different, sharing in the immortal existence of the soul, such that it would not be again subject to death. So, of course, you've already guessed where I'm going with this. This is, of course, exactly what Christians believe about the death of Jesus, that he died in a very violent way by crucifixion with hundreds of witnesses, friends as well as enemies, government officials as well as religious leaders who were there witnessing his death. He was run through with a sword even after he had died. So there can be no doubt that he was dead, and then he was put in the grave and laid there for 3 days. And then, according to the accounts that come down to us in the Gospels, what happened? He came back. He came back in his own body, but it was in such a form that he could do things like pass through closed doors, appear one time in one place and then suddenly in another place, appear in a way that kind of disguised his identity and then revealed it to his friends, to his close friends, with the marks of his death in his very body. And in such a way that it was evident to all that he would not be subject to death again, that he had definitively overcome death, triumphed over death. So for those who saw the resurrection of Jesus in the sense that they saw him after he had risen, I guess you could say nobody saw him in the moment of the resurrection, except the angels, perhaps, who were there in the tomb. But those who saw him risen from the dead had a sort of empirical evidence, like Thomas could put his hand in Jesus' side. But what about us? Well, we believe in the testimony of those who saw Jesus from the dead, that testimony that was faithfully passed down first by mouth and then in writing in the Gospels from generation to generation until today. So we believe because they saw. We don't see, and yet we believe. Is this just wishful thinking? Well, no. I mean, that's where we have to depart from Clarence Darrow. We do believe in the resurrection of the body as Christians. That's part of our creed. And that belief in the resurrection of the body helps us to continue to hold and to hold more firmly to the belief in the immortality of the soul, which I think many of us, even if some of us are huge fans of Socrates, which I am, but even us, we might have trouble in consistently holding to that belief in the immortality of the soul when our own death comes or when loved ones are dying. If it weren't for this other belief that comes right along with it, the immortality of the soul. So that belief, for which we need faith, right? We can't get there through reason to the resurrection of the body. That belief helps us to hold more strongly to what we could know, in fact, by reason, that our souls will live forever. That ascent also requires something more. It actually requires supernatural faith, which I haven't gotten into here. But it's important to acknowledge that although we do believe on the testimony of the apostles and their successors, we would not believe effectively unless we believed through this gift of supernatural faith, because it's ultimately not belief in a teaching or a set of propositions, which we could do even if we were just philosophers. It's belief in a person, right? So it's belief in the resurrection of Jesus, which is our hope for our own eternal life, our own resurrection, our hope for God, right? Because the resurrection of Jesus isn't just to console us about death or to make us not be so afraid of death. It's to give us hope that we can reach God, right? Because this is precisely why Jesus came and suffered and died to bring us to God so that we might live with him forever.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.